Radio Free Press, a podcast from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
The very name Rupert Murdoch needs no further introduction. No business dynasty has had a greater impact on the British news media than the Murdochs. The family's influence has been all-pervasive, from newspapers to satellite television and the internet. And the scandal over tapping into messages on mobile phones is a timely illustration of the abuse of media power. But how did Rupert Murdoch build up such a massive media conglomerate here in the United Kingdom? How did he establish the country's wealthiest broadcaster, BSkyB, and become the UK's biggest publisher of national newspapers? A timely exhibition, whopping 25 years on, holds the answer. Murdoch's newspapers like The Sun, Sunday Times, News of the World became a license to print money once News International sacked 5,500 print workers and moved production to a non-union print works at Wapping in East London. Wapping, 25 years on, tells the grim tale of the bitter struggle to win back jobs and restore trade union rights. Now, with me is the organiser of this exhibition, Anne Field. You were intimately involved in the dispute. Anne Field, what are you trying to say as people arrive at this exhibition and look at these placards about the dispute?
One of the first panels to look at refers directly to Rupert Murdoch, the rise of a media baron. And of course, he's never, ever been very far away from the headlines himself. And it's very important to recall the huge controversy when he, as the proprietor and owner of the low-life News of the World and Sun, as it had become, he then needed the legitimacy of buying the Times and the Sunday Times in order to complete his UK empire, consolidate his earnings, and make it to the big time in the United States. And of course, he was earning huge amounts of money from this revamped news international organisation.
So I was right, was I, in saying that it became a licence to print money?
It had already become a licence to print money before the dispute started. He earned £47 million from his UK operation before the dispute, and that quadrupled after the dispute.
John Bailey, you were also intimately involved in the dispute. You were with the National Graphical Association and worked on The Sun, on their chapel. How did you, as one of those workers, feel when suddenly the Murdochs did this moonlight flit to the new printing works? Because this is what this exhibition is trying to tell.
Yes, the exhibition does tell exactly the details of how everything went wrong. But it started off rather well, with the unions cooperating with Murdoch when he first of all bought the News of the World, and the then editor said we didn't want the Czechoslovakian Jew, Maxwell, or the grandson of a convict taking over something as English as roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. So we knew first of all that there was going to be trouble, and there was from the very beginning. Murdoch did try to interfere, and he interfered more and more, I'm afraid to say, with the help and connivance of many, many other people, including journalists, at that time, who trod Murdoch's line ever downwards.
Anne Field, you were with the other principal union, SOGAT.
Yeah.
What was the impact on your members when you suddenly found, as a union official, that suddenly they'd lost their jobs, 5,500 of them? Because that's clearly what you're trying to tell, isn't it? That gripping story.
Well, it is. I mean, particularly as all of the workers at The Sun and News of the World on the print side had fully expected to go to Wapping, and had been in discussions and negotiations with the company to do that. So when when it became clear that the company, in fact, was setting up a shadow workforce and was trying to find ways of eliminating the existing workforce, everyone was in shock. The strike began on the 24th of January 1986. 5,500 men and women were sacked immediately. And then within a matter of a couple of days only, the union was then in court being threatened with the sequestration of funds for any solidarity action. So the number of workers from SOGAT at the time was 4,200, but in addition to that, there were many temporary and regular casual workers who also lost their jobs.
what's quite clear, isn't it, as the dispute moves on, that the law of the land, the employment laws, were very much on the side of Murdoch. Let's just look now at the plight of how that affected the sacked workers. Here at placard number 5, it says quite clearly, the sacked workers and their unions. And here you see the workers with the badges on their hats, showing their solidarity. If I could ask you, Graham Dodkins, you were, of course, in the library as a worker on the Times newspaper. You're now the co-author of Bad News, a book that's looking at the history of the Wapping dispute. What was so important about those sacked workers? What did their story say, which differentiated them perhaps from other big disputes?
It was the size and the gravity of the whole dispute. So many people were affected by it. No money coming in to speak of at all. There were other union branches who chipped in every now and then. Someone would rush into a meeting, you know, with some fivers in their hand.
So it was a hard going, was it, financially,
it was
for them?
Absolutely devastating from a financial point of view, yeah. The solidarity was brilliant because the picketing was very, very well done. I mean, so many people turned out from the very first morning, the first Monday morning at Grazing Road. There were hundreds and hundreds of people there. The solidarity remained throughout the disputes, 13 months, which was a long, long time. And at the end, you know, the vast majority of people were still, you know, doing the things that they'd done all through the dispute.
Now, the next placard is talking about how there was a sun-free zone. Yes. It was pretty clear, wasn't it, that this dispute, because, of course, it affected popular newspapers, which connected with a lot of people, it was inevitable, wasn't it, that the dispute was going to connect with a lot of people. Yes. What sort of feedback do you think there was from the public during those bitter first few months of the dispute?
Well, it was very mixed. I mean, it was very difficult for people to be travelling up to picketing on, you know, on the tube and see people reading the Sun and the other papers. It was very difficult. And worse than that, friends and family weren't always, you know, very helpful. They often had a different view. We used to go as families up to the, you know, to the marches at Wapping. We'd take our children. Grandparents would come. And other members of the family would say, well, you know, you're putting your family at risk. And it was very difficult.
Anfield, that's what's so remarkable, isn't it, about your exhibition, that you've managed to pull together a lot of quite historic photographs, haven't you, of the struggle that we've just been hearing about?
Yes, the exhibition is primarily photographic, but we've also got many documents as well as photographs that we're scanning in. That people can look at on screen. But the point about the exhibition is to portray the effect in a number of ways. The effect on people and their families, the effect and the way that the laws were used against trade union organisations, but also trade unionists, and to also show how the company was able to manipulate the law, manipulate government and manipulate press ownership in order to get what they wanted.
John Bailey, yes. You, of course, had been on The Sun. And here's this placard, look, The Sun Free Zone. Did it hurt a bit? Does it hurt a bit now, looking at the way the paper was abused? But also, equally, one has to say, how it remained very supportive, didn't it, of the government of the day, of the Conservative government?
Yes, that was always the case, and this exhibition does nothing more than rekindle all those adverse memories. The Sun had been a problem for many of us working on the newspaper for a number of years. We'd campaigned with the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom to try to change the attitude of the editorial direction, and failed, of course, although we did stop the paper on a number of occasions. But it was quite clear that the Sun was completely out of control. And I think in some respects, the fact that the Sun could have been off the streets if we'd won was in some respects a consolation. There were very many different attitudes, I have to say, right throughout the whole business. But what comes back to me as a very strong memory is how people pulled together. And today it might be difficult for trade unionists who aren't necessarily allied to one particular skill to have made such a strong impact. And today, of course, with 5,500 people being sacked almost daily, it wouldn't have the same repercussions. But to us, and to, I think, the country at large, certainly to those people I spoke to, both here and abroad, this was a major, major dispute, and this was a change in industrial direction that had not been witnessed previously.
But I must put to all three of you the fact that, of course, this dispute split the union movement in a way, especially I as a journalist noticed very distinctly, that there were some journalists who were prepared to work and there were some who joined the strike and became what were known as the refuseniks because they refused to work. Anfield, how significant was it that there was this reluctance on some parts of the trade union movement to give you the support that you felt you needed?
Well, I think the trade union movement as a whole did support us. Yes, there was a view at the time and there's a view now that industrial action should have been called. But the fact was that at the time that the Tory laws that had been introduced were specifically designed to stop people taking action. And I think there's a distinction to be drawn between those who didn't feel able to give us industrial action support and those who specifically went against us. And the ones who specifically went against us was the leadership of the WETPU and some of the villains that they used at the time to collaborate with Murdoch.
You have that big poster there,
right,
about the strike
absolutely.
Breakers.
It's the strike breakers and the traitors at the gate. So we must draw a distinction between workers feeling reluctant to support and those as part of a coterie who are there to undermine and to obliterate trade unionism. And the point that we're trying to make is that there was a section within the ETU at the time, including at leadership level, who were not trade unionists. They were villains within the trade union movement. They collaborated with Murdoch and they were exposed. Unfortunately, they have already been consigned to the dustbin of history, which is where they remain. Unfortunately, we didn't get widespread support from the journalists. There should have been more, but over 100 brave souls did refuse to go with the company and supported, as a matter of principle, the action taken by 5,500 of their colleagues. So we're commemorating that as well.
Graham Dodkins, in your research for Bad News, were you struck by that fact that there was this division within the trade union movement? For example, the Electricians Union, the EEPTU, as Anfield has mentioned, they were the union that did the deal with Murdoch and allowed this overnight flit to take place. There was this difficulty among trade unions. Were you surprised, looking back on it now with the hindsight of history, that these splits were so deep?
I think shock would be the best way to describe it. I mean, we weren't really aware of the EETPU being taken taking positions at Wapping until quite late on. I mean, it was just little kind of rumours that kept that emerged, were slipping in, and then I believe someone in, I think it was Sogat, managed to actually get into the plant, having known someone in the ETPU or whatever, and saw the magnitude of it, the huge building. The surveillance cameras and the electricians not just setting up the machinery but working, being trained to actually work the machinery.
Now, John Bailey, let's bring this in our final look at the final panel there. You're talking about the unions today, it's time to fight back. Let's just look at where the newspaper industry has been left after the Wapping dispute. Now, look ahead. What do you think are the chances for getting union recognition at some of these key plants that Rupert Murdoch owns and where he publishes his papers, for example?
It's very difficult to see Murdoch ever allowing trade union membership to flourish at any of his plants. But it's worth pointing out today that Murdoch still pays some of the highest rates to printers anywhere in the country.
Absolutely.
And it's also important to remember that Fleet Street was a very, very close community, that we did not get the support which we anticipated from people within our own unions because people had the impression that we were greedy printers. We were not greedy printers. Printers in Fleet Street were always in the vanguard for any social problems, workers' problems, or industrial problems that emanated outside of Fleet Street. So in that respect, we were rather shocked, I think, in some respects. We had been insular and we had seen perhaps not things working out the way they did. But there is a future. And I think today that with the support of this kind of display and other similar arrangements, and this will travel the country, that people will begin to understand that unity is strength, and that people can get together and unite in their workplaces to the benefit of everyone. And that's the important thing.
Mm-hmm. And Graham Dodkins, do you feel that this exhibition will resonate with today, with what we're hearing, the name Murdoch in the news almost daily?
Well, yes, inevitably it will. It must do, mustn't it? It's strange that the anniversary has coincided with the Murdoch's problems, if you like. Whether it will, I don't know what the outcome will be, but it seems that with the phone tapping thing, that it's actually that the evidence is creeping higher and higher up. If it reaches Murdoch, well then I think the man's actually in quite a lot of trouble, but we'll see what happens.
Final word to you, Anfield. Obviously this exhibition has meant a lot to you because you're looking back on what happened 25 years ago and you've certainly brought it to life. This exhibition brings to life and bring back the memories. What do you hope is going to be the impact on people who walk through the door and see for the first time this chronological history of what, after all, was a very significant dispute if we look at its long-term impact on the newspaper and the media industry in Britain?
My hope is that it is a contribution towards helping people realise that press ownership cannot be unregulated. We cannot have in the UK a situation where somebody can have access to more than 50% or anything like 50% of the adult population, which is what the Murdoch will now be in, position he'll now be in. There, he already with his newspapers controls just under 40% of the UK print media. His organisations are the only part of newspaper printing and publishing in the UK where there is no union recognition at all. There is reunion recognition and collective bargaining in some form or another in all of the other newspaper groups, production and publishing. But unless we have a position of understanding that without a form of regulation, phone hacking is just the tip of the iceberg. The relationship with the police, the relationship with government, it's all about not just profit, but power and influence to smooth the path, to remove all obstacles. And the sacking of 5,500 people in 1986 was part of the process of removing obstacle, any obstacle, not only to profit, but also to power and influence over government, both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, thank you, Anfield, for bringing us right up to date and explaining why this exhibition, whopping 25 years on, has so many resonances with the media world of today. And thank you also to Graham Dodkins and John Bailey.